who's to say that my uncharitably refusing to help somebody who's in need yesterday is not in its own way just as bad as killing and decapitating someone when you're mentally ill? A person with mental illness has some excuse that they're mentally ill. I have no excuse for being uncharitable yesterday, except that I was feeling a bit lazy.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of those shaping our common life. My guest today is Dr. Gwen Adshead, who is a consultant forensic psychiatrist and psychotherapist, and the author of The Devil You Know, which details her work with violent offenders in secure hospital settings such as Broadmoor. Gwen, I want to kick off with asking you, what are your deep values, or in my language, what is sacred to you?
It's such an interesting question, and yet such a hard one, I think. I remember reading something quite recently which was attempting to distinguish the sacred from that which is kind of desecrated. And I suppose when I think about what is sacred to me, I think about those things that mean most to me, but also have a kind, I suppose, a kind of transcendent and eternal aspect to them. Things that I think are kind of bigger than me, bigger than perhaps than all of us. So when I think about what's sacred, I suppose I think particularly about goodness. I suppose I think about the traditional virtues of faith, hope, and love. I suppose I also think about the sacredness of life on earth and the universe, and something about the eternal qualities of those things. I guess what I'm thinking of in particular is something about, not that the mundane, the quotidian kind of life here on earth is not in itself sacred. I think it is. There's something sacred about our presence here. But I do think there's something also about values that are transcendent as well as immanent. So when I go about my daily business, I suppose I look for the sacred in everything, because I think that kind of helps me to orientate myself around particularly the difficult things that one has to deal with.
Could you say a bit more about how that plays out? What does looking for the sacred in everything look like when you're dealing with deep human suffering and distress and what other people would call evil?
Yes. I mean, I think the reason that I kind of approach it in the way that I've just been saying is because a long, long time ago, I think perhaps as becoming a doctor, you get in touch with people's distress. That in a way, as a doctor, you go where the pain is and you go to where people are struggling. And I think it's been important to me and kind of held me. It's been a kind of the ground of where I stand, I think, is to think that we're all in this together. And that old idea about nothing human is alien to me, which of course is that kind of classical thinking, has been really important to me when I go to approach somebody who's in pain or who's exsanguinating or someone who's done something terrible or someone who's kind of really very disturbed. I think reminding myself of our common humanity and the common beauty of that humanity is being really important as part of the ground of what I'm going to do that day and how I'm going to interact with that person.
I'd love to get a sense of how you have become someone who can do the work that you're doing in the way that you do it. So could you say a little bit about the big ideas that were around in your childhood that were in the air as you were growing up?
Well, I grew up in New Zealand. And I think that's important because New Zealand then as now was kind of a bit ahead of the pack in terms of ecological thinking and of taking the land and the environment very seriously and seeing a kind of interconnectedness between humans and the land they were living on. And that was partly there also in Maori culture and also in Aboriginal culture, which I learned, Australian Aboriginal culture, which I learned a bit about too. So I kind of, that idea of being profoundly connected to the land and the earth and how we might affect that was kind of there in my childhood. But the other thing that was there in my childhood too was that both my parents were practicing Christians. And so we went to church every Sunday I went to church from an early age, so from five. And that was partly because that was my parents' tradition as well. I mean, they'd been raised in that tradition of going to church every Sunday. But I think I was very lucky too to go to a church. It was an Anglican cathedral in Christchurch. And so I had a very early exposure to that kind of Anglican liturgy and ritual. With music, all the music that goes with that and the Book of Common Prayer, that goes with that. So that was very much around in my childhood and I think had a big influence on me. So the idea again of God being present in the world, was very real to me kind of from an early age. I think the last thing that perhaps was also around, and I can't really tell you how I first heard about it, but I was born in 1960. So I think in the first 10 or 11 years of my life, what I remember was a kind of beginning of emergence of stories about the Holocaust. And for whatever reason, stories of the Holocaust made a deep impression on me. I suppose I'm probably read The Diary of Anne Frank, but I know that I was interested even then, about how it could be that human beings could do such terrible things to each other. So that was kind of always there in the background of how bad can it be? How badly can it be between human beings?
I'm skipping ahead somewhat, but I have heard you speak about your faith as an adult, but I wonder if it was a kind of continuous thing or you're someone who had a dark night of the soul or a crisis of faith before returning to it.
Yes, no, I think my kind of Christian faith has been very ordinary in that respect. I think that I was raised, as I said, I was raised culturally Christian. And, you know, that was a strong attachment for me, I think. I know it was, you know, so Christmas and Easter and festivals and the music of that, that was all very real to me. And I went to a Church of England school as well. So we had assembly in the mornings and same as secondary school. So cultural Christianity was very sort of real for me, but I think it would be fair to say that it was kind of skin deep, I think, and was much more to do with wanting to be a good person, which is of course is a good thing to aim for. But I think I had an idea as I think it's not uncommon in organized religions. I think I had an idea that if I did, you know, if I did kind of things, if I turned up at church and I did the kind of basic things, then that would mean that I was a Christian. And I think I really wasn't a Christian at all. I think I was, even going through the motions is not quite right. It was kind of more about putting on an identity like an overcoat, but taking it off. I And it really wasn't until I went through a really, I had a pretty miserable decade between age 40 and 50 where my marriage broke down and all sorts of things, just all sorts of things went wrong. But mainly the loss of my marriage and illness in the family and a lot of real pain. I think that was the first time I really experienced intense psychological pain. And I didn't really know what to do with myself. I was so disturbed. But then God was there. I had such a strong sense of being held, not necessarily soothed or comforted, but held while I was struggling. And it was very powerful and hard, you know, hard to articulate more than that. But what that did was to, what that experience did was to make me rethink completely everything I had thought before. And began to think much more about the being rather than the doing, if that makes sense.
It really does. And we'll return to it because one of the questions reading your work and listening to you I've had is, where does it come from, this ability to hold radical compassion towards people that the rest of society would really rather not have to not just have compassion for, but engage with in any way. But let's fill in some of the gaps because you came back to the UK for boarding school when you were about 11. When did medicine as a career seem like the path that you were going to follow?
Oh, that happened very early on. That happened when I was about 7. I was given a book called All About the Human Body, which I still have a copy of, because it made such a deep impression on me. It was then that I wanted to be, that's when I first thought about doing medicine. I had two grandparents who were doctors. Medicine seemed like a popular choice. I mean, my parents were, particularly my mother was particularly, happy for me to train as a doctor, become a doctor. So I really stuck with that idea. I mean, all the way through school and never really considered anything else and went off to Bath, one of the London medical schools when I was 18.
Mm. In one of your case studies that the sort of composite portraits in The Devil You Know, you talk about David, who's a GP who comes to you wanting to, well, who reveals a dark secret about himself, whether he wants to or not, is one of the reasons it's so fascinating. But you said, for some doctors, and I think I may have been one of them once, choosing to study medicine in the first place seemed a way to avoid vulnerability. Just say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Oh, no, I do feel this very strongly that there's, there are many reasons for doing medicine, some more manifest than others. But I think that I was, and perhaps still am, somebody who is uneasy with being vulnerable, uneasy with being dependent on others. And this is partly because, there are a number of reasons for it, that at least I think they may be reasons, if reason is the right word. But I do think that many, many societies and perhaps particularly socio-democratic capitalist societies like ours are very uncomfortable with the idea of vulnerability and dependence. And there are lots of public discourses that are very, very much emphasize autonomy, independence, self-control, self-containment, and the kind of image of us all being sort of billions of billiard balls kind of bouncing off each other, you know, is I think that metaphor is still very popular in some ways, you know, or it kind of speaks to people that, you know, you do you. Isn't that the kind of, is very much the kind of language now? You do you and I'll do me and we'll be independent. We might bounce off against each other, but we won't be interrelated. Whereas, you know, the reality is completely the opposite. But to be dependent is to be in touch with neediness, to be in touch with vulnerability, but also to be in touch with the uncertainty and the complexity of being connected to others. And I think I was very avoidant of that. I think at a very practical level, because I was largely looking after myself from an early age, being vulnerable was kind of something that I didn't want to think about. So, and I think that quite a number of people go into medicine in order to locate their neediness and vulnerability in somebody else and look after it there. And I think I may well have been one of those people. And that doesn't have to be a bad thing, so long as you don't denigrate vulnerability and neediness in others. And I think there can be sometimes a tendency in medicine, not always, a tiny bit of, you know, denigration of the vulnerable status. And that, I mean, that's in a much wider context of hierarchical statuses where power, being powerful and independent is better than being vulnerable. Which is, of course, is why the message of Christianity has always been so radical, because it talks about foolishness and weakness and things going wrong and writing in the dust and people who are not wanted being invited in, and the person who's identified as a criminal turns out to be someone who is infused with a much greater love and power than ever anticipated by anybody. That's an extraordinary story.
It really is. I hadn't really made the link between the criminality of Jesus and your work. But let's I'd love to know, reading about your career, you know, there's this training as a doctor and specializing in psychiatry and then getting interested in the medico-legal reporting, making judgments for the courts. And your book taught me that the word forensic just means associated with the law, you know, and then training in psychotherapy, adding all these strings to your bow and eventually ending up in this extraordinary position that you write about in the book of doing talking therapy with patients in Broadmoor, which UK readers will know, listeners will know, but for people otherwise, otherwhere in the world, is the high security hospital for violent offenders with significant mental health. I'm probably mangling all the language, forgive me, but the shorthand works. What was the thread that you're pulling on that got you from training as a doctor to sitting opposite a serial killer or a child rapist in Broadmoor, trying to help them understand their crimes?
Well, I think of it as a golden cord, I think, perhaps, rather than a single thread, because I think there were a number of threads. But I think the first thread was something about the potential for each of us to do something terrible or to get into an evil state of mind. I think that potential, and that was something that my father really taught me, was something about not judging other people, about just not making judgments and assumptions about people, but especially not judging people because who knows whether you might not have done something just as bad in the similar circumstances. And in fact, more than that, you know, who's to say that my, for example, uncharitably refusing to help somebody who's in need yesterday is not in its own way just as bad as killing and decapitating someone when you're mentally ill. I mean, and the person with mental illness has some excuse that they're mentally ill. I have no excuse for being uncharitable yesterday, except that I was feeling a bit lazy. So that's one of the threads, is not seeing a great difference, necessarily seeing a huge difference between me and these other people, except perhaps a question of degree. And of course, the question of my privilege in terms of, you know, if you go into mental health, you know, you meet people who are often, you know, grossly deprived of all sorts of things that many of us take for granted. And if you go into forensic mental health, you certainly, generally, the vast majority of people you meet will have been raised in poverty, lucky to have gotten to school or stayed in school, lucky to have friends, lucky to have a partner, have appalling relationships with parents if they have any at all, and be kind of, you know, eking out an existence on benefits and petty crime and kind of, you know, addiction problems. So you get exposed to the kind of, you know, different ends of the world. So, and I think that that awareness of poverty and its claims upon us and, was kind of part of that, that those of us who have a duty to go and share what we've got, I think. I mean, I was always interested in justice. I mean, I think, and justice and judgment. So, I mean, I was partly drawn to the work. I mean, it started with the philosophy of it. But because I was interested in how courts could decide whether mental illness could alter your responsibility or not, it's a very profound philosophical question. But of course, the Christian message that I'd been grown up with was A, certainly not to judge, and B, and not that forgiveness was available to everybody. So if forgiveness was available to everybody was the gospel message, then I was certainly not going to be in a position to reject or treat badly those whom the gospel said would be welcome in the kingdom of heaven. And you know, the Matthew 25 chapter, it was all written out as clear as day. When I was in prison, you visited me. You know, when did I see you in prison? Well, when you went to see prisoners, you went to see me. So those three things, I think, the not judging, realizing that, it, you know, that my capacity for sinfulness and cruelty was just the same as theirs. It was just that it was on a different scale. It was a tune played on a piccolo as opposed to on the full orchestra version, but it might not be that different in kind or nature. And then something about not judging and trying to contribute to justice. And then that third thing about not rejecting those who God was not rejecting. If the Lord was not rejecting them, then I was in no position to reject them either.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. Thanks very much. I have to confess, we share an agent, and Sophie handed me your book very early on in our conversations. It sat on my shelf for a long time because I thought that book will be too dark for me to read. I have ridiculously low tolerance for particularly children in distress, but, you know, I'm working on it, but I don't have high tolerance for trauma.
No. I hear you. I was the same.
But it's not dark, which is a very strange thing to say about stories of people who have committed the acts that we as a society hold to be most atrocious. And it's not dark because you tell the stories of these people, your patients, and their lives that have led up to these disasters with such tenderness and empathy and compassion that the reader cannot help but end up understanding. And there's a tension in that because everything you're saying, you know, and I share your faith, so, and hopefully most of the time in theoretically I'm where you are, but it is an offensive thing. It sounds offensive to a lot of people and to the kind of dominant ways we think about crime and victims and perpetrators and good and evil, to spend as much attention and empathy and curiosity, and in your case, you know, professional time and energy, understanding the people who have caused such harm to those elsewhere. And yet I very much agree with you that it is necessary. It's a necessary journey for us to go on. And I didn't want to go on it. You know, I didn't want to be asked to have compassion for these people. You must get that response a lot. What's your kind of, what's your way that you hold that?
Well, you're quite right. It is a response I get a lot. And I think it is undoubtedly true that many people, before they read the book, assumed, well, not unreasonably, I think, that it was going to be a kind of true crime book with, lots of lingering on human suffering and a kind of, what I can only describe as kind of salacious excitement, at other people's cruelty. And I was very, very keen, as I think you can probably imagine, I was very, very keen to communicate how much the work is not like that. That because so much of the work is tragedy, is tragic. This is particularly true in a place like Broadmoor, where people have committed acts of violence, usually, I know, always, I think, in very disturbed states of mind. And so when they kind of recover some kind of mental health, the realization of what they've done is often unbearable, and very distressing, particularly for people who've killed family members. But also because they realize that by doing what they've done, they kind of kill off all the kind of connections that make for a very, you know, enjoyable and happy human life. So they are people who are in the most desperate kind of state. And I think that one of the values that's driven me here is that concept that, and I can't remember who's most famous for having said it, lots of different people have said it in different ways, but the idea that the way we treat the worst of us is a guarantee for how we treat the best of us. That if we're treating the worst of us with dignity and respect and compassion, then that will probably guarantee that the best of us will get it too. But if we create a group of people who we say are not worthy of any human attention or compassion or respect, then that is a very dangerous precedent to set. Because it may look very obvious that this group of people here that we call nasty people X, that it's all right to kick them about and treat them as dirt and hate them and denigrate them and be very, very excited about how good you are in comparison to them. But history tells us that it's very unwise to allow a denigrated group to emerge as legitimate victims. And countries, societies have paid very heavily for that. And we're still paying. We're all still paying for what happened in 1930s Germany. And finally, my other thought is that I just refuse to subscribe to the idea that there's not enough compassion to go around. You know, compassion for perpetrators of violence doesn't mean that I don't have perpetrators, but compassion for victims of their violence or other kinds of trauma. There's enough compassion to go around. And not only that, there's enough care to go around. It's all about priorities. You know, I think there's no reason why victims of violence and trauma shouldn't have good quality therapy and treatment. And it's ludicrous that we don't provide proper interventions for victims of childhood trauma and adult trauma. It's bizarre. You know, it really is bizarre that, you know, that those services exist to some extent, only to some extent, for people who've been, you know, who have been violent when mentally ill. But, you know, trying to get disturbed children therapy is almost impossible. And, you know, I think, you know, I'm, you know, I won't be around to see it, but I'm cautiously hopeful that in another couple of hundred years, they'll look back on us as kind of we look back on medieval times. You know, who were these people? They put men on the moon. They did replacement knees. They did replacement hearts and lungs. They could even make three-dimensional things with a computer, but they didn't take mental health seriously at all.
Yes, it feels to me like that. And I listened to a few interviews with you with people getting really angry with you, right? Or at least being very combative with you. And I think that I was trying to understand it to myself. And I think it is that sense of which we only have so much compassion. And so, you know, and we've obviously developed these categories, particularly now, where there is the category of victim and there is the category of perpetrator, and they are hermetically sealed. One of the things your book does is really shows how that's not true. You can be both, and many people are both. And I think this sense of I'm not the same. You know, I can even feel it myself, as you're saying, you know, my uncharitableness to the person on the street who asked for help is not dissimilar. And the desire to say that's not the same. You know, there is such a thing as evil and evil people, and they need punishing, that we can take revenge on people that have hurt us, seems to me to be bubbling up again as a story that we are telling as a society, that externalizing evil into the other rather than acknowledging it as a deep condition of the human heart and a temptation that we're all prone to is it more live, or am I just hearing it more loudly? What do you think?
It's such an interesting question. I suspect that it has always been there. I think that the wish to other somebody and locate badness in somebody else, and then enjoy attacking them because of it, has been there throughout human history. And I think it's there in John 8 with the story of the adulterous woman. You know, these men are, you know, so excited about the prospect of stoning her to death. And then it all kind of fades away. And there's just a woman and Jesus and a writing in the dust that we know not what, and the letting go and don't do it anymore. I don't condemn you, but go and do something different. And I think the very strong wish to make yourself feel better by making somebody else feel bad is, that is part, I think, of the human condition, or in terms of our capacity for evil. Thomas Aquinas said we have a disposition both to evil and to goodness. And I think our disposition to evil often starts from, from the idea that I'll make myself feel good by making somebody else look bad. And I think that has to be resisted. Now, of course, you know, you don't need our religious discourse to make this real or valid. But I think it is interesting that across history, human history, it has been religious and theological discourses or discourses of spirituality that have invited us to examine our own hearts before we go judging other people's. And that's very important. Interestingly, you could almost argue that it's important evolutionarily wise, because we need to live in groups. We are group animals, by biology, if you like to talk that kind of talk. You know, there are quite a lot of evolutionary thinkers in psychology and psychiatry, and I have some sympathy with the idea that, you know, we are a kind of, you know, we are a primate like gorillas and chimpanzees. We are group animals. We have to live in groups. We have to be mindful of other people's minds. And we have to be able to also to ride a boundary between our own minds and the minds of others. And judging each other. I mean, you talk about this beautifully in your book, actually, about the negotiation of boundaries and rules. When a group of people come to live together, there has to be negotiation, and that negotiation is not always comfortable. And negotiating conflict and negotiating the negative feelings that go with conflicts and disagreements and jealousies and anger and deprivation, all those kind of human stuff, that's about taking our own minds seriously, but also the minds of others. And they all have to be real. And the worry that I have about saying those people over there are terrible and we over here are great is that it's not very real. It's not reality based. So, I mean, there was a marvelous example of this, on the radio the other week. Somebody did an article about the recent riots and the recent horrible riots. And they were a BBC reporter who'd gone down to cover the riots. And some of the rioters saw them and said, oh, they're from the BBC. That means they're paedophile scum. So kind of, you know, the worst thing you could possibly say to anybody, very ordinary journalists, you know, are paedophile scum. And that's kind of meaningless, but it's a meaningless offense, but it's meant to say, you are people, we hate you, but it's not very realistic. It's not like they have done anything except come and do what they're meant to be doing. But there's something a bit mad about it, truthfully. And I use that word advisedly because madness is about a failure of reality testing. And reason, you know, reason and reality and truth are crucial here.
How this is making me think, because my impression of the mental health world in general, perhaps medicine in particular, is a pretty secular. How unusual are you as such a senior psychiatrist and psychotherapist to be so open and drawing publicly, or at least even personally, on your faith? Is it less secular than I think it is? Because I can imagine people saying that faith itself is a delusion.
Well, yes and no, perhaps. I mean, I think that undoubtedly that there's a kind of there's a spectrum, I think, Elizabeth. I think that's the reality. There's a spectrum. As you know as well as I do, that within the sciences generally, there's a spectrum of beliefs, and many scientists have had very strong faith systems of different kinds in supporting them in their work. And I think that medicine in general and psychiatry in particular is no different. So we have a spectrum of spiritual thinking and faiths within the practice of psychiatry. We have a spirituality special interest group, which is either the biggest or the second biggest special interest group in the college. And that is because I think you can't practice psychiatry without thinking about values. Well, you can't practice medicine without thinking about values. I'm thinking now of the work of a wonderful colleague called Professor Bill Fulford, who's a moral philosopher as well as a wonderful psychiatrist, and who wrote a marvelous book about facts and values and values-based thinking in medicine and especially in psychiatry, and the importance of having facts, good quality facts, but also an understanding of people's values. And that is particularly live in mental health, because in order to understand a person who seems very disordered in front of you, you need to understand, a bit like how you started with me, you need to understand something about their values and their belief systems and who they've been in their lives in order to understand how they come to be before you, either, you know, grossly depressed or wild of eye and listening to voices, or having, you know, sort of run amok and disemboweled three people in Swindon or whatever it happens to be. Doesn't have to be Swindon, that person, you know, has been a, you know, before you meet them, they've had their own lives and their own values and their own story to tell of relationships and life. And as a psychiatrist, you're going to need to know something about that if you're going to really get to understand them and help them to change their minds for the better.
Yes, I'm thinking of, you must have some, the kind of radical, the radical compassion, the radical curiosity and care that it takes to sit close with, you know, Ian in the book, who is a child sex offender, and take both yourself and the reader on a journey whereby the tragic end of his life, I was devastated by, requires something, right? It requires some moral framework, some commitment to hold you in relationship with people that commit these radical acts of harm to other people. To sort of pull it back to the realm of what most listeners will have to deal with in their lives, which is more kind of ordinary difference, more people they disagree with, that they are tempted to reject for reasons of different tribe or different worldview or whatever it is, maybe criminals, maybe people who've committed acts of violence or less. What helps you hold that posture? What helps you stay committed to their full humanity, even though you might, you know, think they need to be restrained or be involved in the justice system or whatever the equivalents are in listeners' examples that they're holding in their heads?
Yes, and I just want to start my answer by saying it's really important to me what you've just said, which is there's nothing about offering a kind of compassionate and therapeutic listening and attention to the realities of what people have done. None of that is an alternative to the ordinary processes of justice in terms of people being found guilty, and none of what I've been thinking about and writing about for the last decade or so is about excusing people, nor indeed do I think that people shouldn't be offended or outraged when they hear about something terrible happening. I'm an ordinary person, you know, when I hear about the terrible events in Southport, I feel that in my heart, like anybody else. I feel a sense of outrage. But most of all, I feel massive distress on behalf of, yes, the families, but also the young man who did that and his family too, and the terrible journey that faces them as well as the families of the children who were killed and the other people who had to witness that. This is a kind of disaster of sort of such massive proportions. It's kind of cataclysmic. It's kind of cosmic. Yeah. And it kind of disturbs the order of the universe. And I think what what sustains me is a belief in the goodness and order of the universe, that goodness exists as much as evil does. And that we absolutely have to hold on to that, and it's a duty to be hopeful. Faith, hope, and love, these three, these are duties. They're not simply a kind of, you know, sort of lovely ornament on life. They're a duty. They're a way of relating to the world, so that relating to goodness is really important. Growing that capacity for goodness and noticing when you're kind of drifting into sort of mean state of mind is really important, I think. So what sustains me is that belief that cultivating goodness is as real as important as the evil that happens in the world. And that actually I worry that we don't pay enough attention to goodness, that in every single act of terrible human evil is reported in enormous depth. Although having said that, the news cycle moves on very swiftly. And, I know how many of us are holding in our prayers the families of those little girls right now, today. Right now at this moment, those families in kind of unspeakable pain. You can only do that if you also believe that goodness, truth, and beauty exist in an ultimate form, which is ultimately as real as anything that humans can do, if not realer, if not bigger.
Dr. Gwen Adshead, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Well, as you could probably hear, I have very deep respect for Gwen. It's actually sometimes the most difficult interviews to do when I'm a little bit awed by the person that I'm talking to. And I was trying to put my finger on why this is, and she's obviously extraordinarily impressive and eminent. You know, she's been president of the Royal College of all kinds of things, and is, you know, one of the most respected professionals in her field. She's done Desert Island Discs, which is a big deal in my head. But I've spoken to a lot of very impressive people. And I think what it is with Gwen is that her calling and vocation is what I think of as the like proper version of the thing I feel very passionate about, is the sort of extreme end of it. She is sitting and listening to and seeking to understand people whose lives and life experience and the things they've done are so radically different from her and so radically different from most of us listening to this podcast. And doing it with such curiosity, compassion, empathy, knowledge, professionalism. And I just think it's extraordinary. There's a moral beauty in it that is, I personally find very, very compelling. You know, she talked about going to where the pain is and that nothing in humanity is foreign to me. The courage of that, I'm left with real respect. And I would strongly advise you to read her book. And I don't do that on the podcast this often because I read a lot of books for the podcast and some of them are great and some of them are fine and some of them tell me a lot about the author and some of them don't, but it's not a books podcast. And my least favorite thing about books podcasts is the way they enthusiastically endorse every single book that they've had on. And so I really try and avoid that. But this one I would say is it's a real standout. So yeah, respect for Gwen. The second thing to say is think about how she got to where she is. It started with curiosity. Yeah, it started with a question. How do people end up there? How do they end up in Broadmoor? And the portraits in the book are obviously composites because of patient confidentiality, but they are a collection of people who have done the worst things. There's an arsonist, there's someone who's had repeated children taken away, various people who've killed various people. And the idea that reacting to that, not with, or not just with, abhorrence and rejection and revulsion, but with a question, how did you end up here? How did your life, as she puts it, spin so wildly out of control? And that thing about reading about Anne Frank in her childhood and thinking, you know, where does this come from? Where does evil come from? And the incredibly challenging and compassionate response that comes through from Gwen is it comes from the repeated failures of people to care for each other. She makes a very strong case that the vast majority of people who commit violent acts grew up in poverty and without the care of others, you know, without adequate parenting, without a sense of safety, a sense of seenness. And I can feel the voice in my head going, that doesn't excuse it. And it's not that she's saying it excuses it. She's saying we need to understand. We need to understand the impact of the way we structure society and of the choices that we make on us and on other people, and really carry with awareness those of us who did grow up with a level of safety and a level of seenness, the gift of that and the privilege of it. Yeah. Listening to Gwen and reading her tell the stories of these violent offenders reminded me again why I'm so interested in the stories, why I'm so interested in how people get to where they are, how they formed their values, their formation. There's a quote in the front of the book that's by Carl Jung, and it says, evil comes into the world when people cannot tell their stories. It's thought-provoking, right? Do I fully believe that? I don't know. I think an ability to tell and own and integrate our stories is part of what's going on. And the final thought I'm left with is how much I don't want to understand what I've just said, right? How much I don't want to know the suffering and struggle of other people. I don't want to be asked to have compassion on people that have murdered someone else, or less than, right? Not even close to, most of the time, it's just people who've pulled out in front of me on the motorway, or, you know, whole political opinions I don't agree with, or the kid that was mean to my kid, right? I'm so far off the level that Gwen is at. But that I think that this is what this practice has called me to. The more I listen, the more I seek to understand where people are coming from, the more it becomes clear to me that an appropriate response is curiosity, is an acknowledgement of how people's circumstances shape them and the legacy that we leave on each other. And I was having an uncharacteristic day of really feeling the suffering of the other, of other people the other day. I was very tired, and I had Mina Salami, who is a guest on the podcast we've had on before, uses this phrase, Weltschmerz, world pain, that there are some temperaments, and then it's not really me, but on some days I am overwhelmed by Weltschmerz. I am overwhelmed by the pain of the world. You know, you don't have to look far. People up close, people far away. And my husband said to me, one way of thinking about the Sermon on the Mount, when it says, blessed are those who mourn, is blessed are those who care. You know, blessed are those who are merciful. Blessed are those prepared to look the darkness of the world in the face. And I think I resist that because I worry that I'll go under, that I can't hold it. And so I have a tendency to harden my heart. And sitting with Gwen has made me realize, I don't think she's gone under, right? She's sat up close with people whose lives, they have destroyed their own lives, and their lives were destroyed previously, usually by other people. And there's not that obvious a way back for many of them. But she hasn't gone under, right? There's a joy, quiet joy to her. And that gives me hope that it's true. Blessed are those who care. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and our production team are Dan Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Amari Yagandran. Please look up Theos's wider work and our sister podcast, Reading Our Times. And you can find me at my Substack, morefullyalive.substack.com. Increasingly, I hope, less on social media, but I am there on Instagram and Twitter, and you can contact the Theos team via the Theos website. Until next time.